Greater Britain after the storm. We're used to hearing that we live in an age of unprecedented division in the UK and that the great storms that have engulfed British politics over the past 10 years have driven us further apart than ever with no hope of finding common ground. Penny Mordaunt and Chris Lewis disagree. In Greater Britain after the storm, a lively and insightful book, they argue that though all differences of opinion are natural, a natural part of healthy debate indeed, some of our current division is caused by a need of political reform. To find out more, delighted to be joining me live from the UK, co-author of Greater Britain After the Storm, Chris Lewis. Chris, good morning to you.
Morning, Giles. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And yourself, you're looking fine and dandy this merry morning.
Yeah, considering I was up late last night.
I can't imagine why. Well, there must have been a very interesting documentary on Channel 5 or something then, yes?
Yeah, there was a serious amount of nerve jangling to be done, but it was a very familiar experience, put it that way.
Yes, indeed. And I was just saying to somebody else, because of I live off grid up in the hills, I listened to it on the radio with my friends sending me video links of the best bits and misses and penalties and whatever else. But when it came to penalties, when I knew it was a penalty shootout, I got out of my car and walked into my house because I couldn't bear it. So when I actually sort of got the cat off the bed and had the, you know, the chamomile tea and flicked on the media, it was an all too familiar story. But there you go, eh? Well, it's funny enough because it's one of, I mean, racial knuckle draggers aside, the England football team is something that has brought, like it or not, the, you know, the nation together, at least England together as well. And it's one of the things that, perhaps in a funny kind of way, the Greater looks at, because we're saying, oh, well, there's no possibility that you'll ever get sort of New Labour and old Conservatives hugging at a football match, but it seems to be so.
Well, that's right, Giles. We wrote this book from two different point of views. One was a Brexiteer point of view, and the other one, which was my side of it, which is I didn't vote for Brexit, and I'm not a supporter of policies in this area. But I also am a Democrat, and we are where we are, and we've got to be pragmatic about it. And I think, you know, when you talk about what happened last night, the Brits are very pragmatic, and people are upset about what happened last night. But they also can see we made a lot of progress. You know, it's not often we come second in a big tournament, and so the boys have done really well, and we should be proud of that, and we shouldn't be too hard on them for not winning.
Absolutely. Now, just a shame, James Haskell, the rugby player, had a brilliant post on his social media saying, look, you and I are never going to be in that situation, we haven't trained for that. So there you go. Let's move away from the football, because otherwise we're going to turn into a question of sport if we're not careful. You might argue, though, that the healthy debate in any democratic system is a good thing, but what we have seen over the past decade is perhaps a polarization of these ideals, and this is the problem with bridging that middle ground. It's not so much the process, but maybe perhaps we need to rethink the system.
Well, it's never been the case that an abundance of resource has led to it being more respected. And when you have an abundance of information, then that also becomes less respected. And an abundance of points of view, they become less respected. But if anybody that thinks that this sort of division is a weakness, well, I travel all over the world, and there are some countries I travel to where there is no division. And I can assure you that that in strictly enforced consensus is no sign of strength. Anything more than lively debate is a sign of weakness.
So lively debate is fine, but the problem is, and you say that we've got too much information, perhaps too much of that information is coming through, if you like, unfiltered. Previously, we got our news from the traditional channels, i.e. newspapers, radio, and television. Now, with the advent of the internet and social media, there is no filter, and therefore that information is coming through in a huge wave, somewhat like the front cover of your book, and it's difficult for people to filter out, you know, the good, the bad, and the indifferent.
Yeah, that's right. One of the factors here is the disinhibition that people feel online with communication. They would say things online that they wouldn't dare to say to somebody's face, and they say it from a position of anonymity, and so sometimes that accounts for the debate being you know, beyond the pale from time to time. But the point is that if we're able to debate, there are certain things that we can agree on. And one of the things that we've never really had in Britain is a plan. And we've had the biggest shock to us since probably the Second World War. And like the Second World War, it brought some very very similar conditions, a lot of centralization, a lot of government intervention, a massive amount of spending, and a huge amount of modernization as well. And our point in the book is that after that type of storm, you need to harness that modernization, because COVID has taught us new ways of working, new ways of interacting, new ways of shopping, new ways of working. And we should be guiding that and harnessing that and reforming our politics as well as reforming the way that we live.
So what we're looking at here then is we should be taking the current situation and, if you like, wiping a slate clean. Because, I mean, and we, you know, I run a current affairs phone-in show on a Tuesday, and the number of people who go back to the war, and there's sort of a mass off-screen rolling of eyes when it's talking about the war. But if you like, 1945, Britain wiped the slate clean. We brought in the National Health Service. They kicked out Winston Churchill. They put in the Labour government, which was perhaps not a surprise for those after the war, because the war cabinet wasn't fit for purpose, and then started again. And this should be seen, and you would have thought of the devastation, the loss of men, materials, manpower, industry. But it shaped the way that Britain would go, with the Windrush, with the immigration, with the disintegration of empire. You could argue that this situation we are in now is a massive opportunity to rethink how we work, how we socialize, how we travel, but also how we debate and how we call, you know, we go through our political process.
Yeah, I completely agree that nobody wants to drag up the bloody war again, and nobody wants to go back over history. History is only useful insofar as the further back you can see, the further forward you can also anticipate. I mean, after all, if you're a creative thinker, then your ideas are simply, the new idea is simply history you don't know. So it's very important to recognize that there are lessons to be learned from the past, but also that there is an exciting future here. Because if you're up and coming or you're aspiring and you come from a blue collar background, then this is a good time, because change brings opportunity for those people that can harness it. And our point in the book is that we need to really look at how we reform our political systems in order to make that modernization stick. And that particularly applies to institutions like the House of Lords. So, for instance, today you're seeing the confirmation of another hereditary lord coming into an upper chamber, which is 850 people. Which now means that the majority of our people at Parliament are unelected. We believe that's bad.
But others will point to that and say, yes, but the House of Lords, if you like, is our safety, is our handbrake, is our safety brake. It's the thing that stops, that can stop some of the more sort of wild, perhaps, and spurious laws that the House of Commons might put through?
Well, I would say that there is an argument to be made for wisdom and for knowledge. But why is it that knowledge is excluded to only male wisdom? So over 90 of those seats can only be occupied by men. And are we saying that men have got the monopoly on ideas in the 21st century?
Well, indeed not. It'd be very foolish indeed to go along with that. So also the some of the actions, I mean, I decided to go back to the war again, but I just said after the war, you know, we had a change of government, a new government came in, and NHS was introduced, etc. Looking at some of the murkier aspects of the politicians' private lives and the awarding of contracts and the perceived cronyism of the current government in some quarters. You know, we talk about reforming some of the traditions, but surely it's a time when we are politicians to get the bigger picture, to embrace the bigger ideal about where Britain is going, if it is to be, as it says in your book, greater after the storm.
Yeah, I think that's a very astute observation, because the thing that separated out the Attlee government from the Churchill government was the fact that they had a vision. And one of the things that we need is a plan and a vision to say, look, what is it that we're really good at? Britain is not a dominant nation, it's a challenger nation. And so a definition of a challenger brand is that it's got to do what the competition is unwilling or unable to do. And that means we need to go back to the things that we're known for. People can trust a British brand. Around the world, we had 1,000 years of uninterrupted democracy. And so we were the first people to put together human rights legislation. We're trusted in law. We're trusted in international treaties. There's a lot of things that spring from trust. But without a plan, it's actually very difficult to get people to contribute. And this is where the frustration comes in, because a lot of people are angry that they can't contribute. But if you have a plan, people can see where they can contribute, and we can then harness their potential. That's why we need a plan.
Could you argue, though, but we talk about what we're good at and what Britain has had a reputation for, but could you argue that we are still, in some of our political ideals and some of our media ideas, hamstrung by the hangover of empire, that we still think that we are a global power, that we think we're one of the big world players? And you see things like the launch of a new super yacht that's going to, I forget the minister who said it was going to make, world leaders want to get on and basically sort of kowtow the line to get on this British super yacht, and Britain being a naval power. And if Britain is to reimagine itself, it has to be much more nimble, and it has to be much more proactive rather than reactive and seen as stuttering, dithering.
I think you're right. I think the age of resources and the age of military power alone is coming to an end. What we're entering now is an age of values. And so when we talk about superpowers, what are we talking about? Is it resources? Is it economics? Or is it ideas and values? And one of the things that defines the whole process of Brexit is that Britain's got a different idea of its future and a set of values than Europe has got. I happen to be on the losing side of that argument, but it doesn't mean to say that we don't share the same values. And at some point, somebody's going to have to stick up for the values of democracies, because democracies are working really well. They overtook the number of autocracies around about the turn of the millennium. And people living in those democracies are healthier, they're wealthier, they're more fulfilled. And we've got to, at some point, stick up for the fact that the diversity that we have is our strength. The diversity of opinion, because good ideas don't belong to either the left or the right. They come from both sides.
We talk about the left or the right, but also just reading a report before you came onto the show about the wealth gap that seems to be the perceived wealth gap that's happening between the very rich and the very poor. Some of you are saying the very rich have made £50,000 during the pandemic better off, whilst the very poor in terms of handouts, I think it's something that's about £300. Also, you have the north-south gap between, that BC before COVID, that great northern powerhouse campaign, but that we see sort of Manchester and Liverpool acting almost like sort of robber baron states, saying, well, we're not buying into this narrative. And then, of course, there is the thorny issue of Scotland and Northern Ireland and Wales. And, coming out over the past couple of weeks have been some very disturbing, if you are a unionist, and I mean in terms of Great Britain, rumblings about the fact that this particular situation has reinforced the idea that, they want to look after their own interests.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, the biggest group that's been impacted by COVID is not a nationality, it's a gender. It's women that have actually been really impacted by COVID around the world. They're the ones that have picked up the home education, the childcare, the elderly care, the additional household work, etc. Every survey that's been done so far on COVID says that it's women actually as a group that have been more impacted. But there's no doubt that the whatever gaps there were before in terms of wealth, COVID has accelerated those. So when the Conservative government said it wants to do levelling up, then that job has become much harder as a result of COVID, and it therefore needs to work that much harder. And therefore, if you're going to work harder, why not work smarter and have a better, more a clearer plan where people can subscribe to that and see how they can pursue a role? And that applies to also the four nations of the UK, because so many of those people are full of get up and go. The sad thing is many of them have got up and gone.
Again, and I forget who's to say this, but it's the vision thing, isn't it? And you need a leadership, or you need a party who say, okay, here's what we're going to do. Here's the plan. Here's where you fit in. And at the moment, you can argue that we're not seeing this. You argue in your book as well that, the British people have a remarkable creativity and a remarkable ability to adapt and to come out, and I don't mean to sound like a Conservative MP, as world beaters. How would you advise a government to incentivize, if you like, to you know, put that va-va-voom underneath people to come together, not to be shouting across the anonymous cavern of social media, you know, with a Yaboo sucks playground approach to politics.
Well, I think they've got to start recruiting more people from a representative background, because basically you win when you have people who look like the constituency that you're seeking to serve. And that means, you know, reaching out from beyond the graduate veil. For instance, a lot of MPs now are graduates. There are perfectly good people out there who are not graduates. You don't need a piece of paper to prove you're intelligent. And what, and looking out there to people who are more aspirant and meritocratic. And one of the biggest symbols that they could put forward to do that is to say there can be no places in Parliament where aspiration cannot take you. That's why I make the point about the House of Lords. You know, we must have mobility, not nobility, when it comes to our democracy, because that's what motivates people, allows them to achieve.
Why did you think the time was right then to compose Greater Britain After the Storm? And also, what was it like having, if you like, ideological jousting with Penny Mordaunt, who is not on the same side? Well, ideologically, she was for leaving the European Union.
Well, us working class kids have got to stick together, and we're both ladder climbers, and we both came from blue collar backgrounds, and so we have a lot in common. We have more in common that unites us differentiates us. And one of the things is that as we wrote the book, we discovered that Penny was extremely dyslexic. So that was kind of an interesting journey. Whenever you write a book, you're obviously exploring a lot of ideas and exploring your own thinking as well. So in some respects, writing with somebody who was profoundly dyslexic was also a challenge. And I pay tribute to her courage and her dedication in getting through the writing. And so it shows that when you work together, you can actually overcome some quite big problems. And that's kind of a metaphor for the whole project, which is that, you know, Britain doesn't need a left or a right. It needs a set of people that want to work together. And the best people to give that work to are people who are aspirant, who are energetic, who are visionary, and can harness the power of everybody else, not just an elite class of people that reside in Parliament.
And I mean, who are you speaking to, and what experiences are you drawing on to make these suggestions and perhaps these pointers and of a way forward to make Britain greater?
Well, we went out there with two ears and one mouth. We talked to civil servants. We talked to leaders in all sorts of walks of life, from clergy to the commerce to the military. We went out and talked to a lot of people, and you know, what the overwhelming response from them was, you know, they couldn't understand why we've never had a plan. We always seem to sort of muddle through like dad's army. And it's kind of, we don't seem to be able to sit down and get ourselves organized, because even the notion of getting organized is strangely not very British.
I mean, this is the thing. I mean, when you do a book like this, do you get a greater understanding of what it is to be British? Is there such a thing as being British, or are we Scottish, Northern Irish, Irish, Welsh, or are we Yorkshireman, you know, Lancashire, you know, are we just a, you know, Cornish? Are we a disparate tribe of wandering Celts, Saxons, and everybody else who happened to sort of saunter through a couple of thousand years ago?
No, I think, I mean, we do get a very good idea from talking from left and right across the whole diverse spectrum, is that there are a number of things that people have in common. Generally speaking, very compassionate, very interested in helping other people around the world. You know, 64% of British people give to a charity on a weekly basis, you know, is hugely compassionate. You know, they're caring. The NHS is close to a national religion as you can get. I think above all, though, a similar sense of humour. The sense of humour is something that the Brits paradoxically take very seriously indeed. For British people, it indicates timing, judgment, terms of reference, shared background. And it's the one thing that we found that could unite people from across the spectrum. And one of the best examples that we saw of that was often in politics, where people from completely different, like take Martin McGuinness and Ian Paisley in Northern Ireland, the reason they work so well together is that they had a shared sense of humour. And I think there's a lot to be said for that sort of thing, because it's something that is very grounding and very unifying as a characteristic.
I mean, you could almost argue that Britain is going to be greater in spite of its institutions and its political system rather than as a direct result of its institutions and political system.
Well, I think that's one of the things that comes through, which is that these institutions have got the tide of modernism and history washing through them. And if they don't open up their doors, they will be washed away by it as people take to more direct action because they feel that the processes that are supposed to represent them are just not working anymore.
I mean, did you feel, because this is one of the things, if a political system isn't serving the people it's supposed to purportedly represent, then there is the danger of extremism on all sides of the more alternative view, should we say, the alt-right or the alt-left or whatever, gaining because the people feel disenfranchised, they feel not listened to. Young communities, young Asian communities feeling disenfranchised throughout the north of England. I mean, does that worry you?
I think it does. And I think one of the things that comes through very clearly here, and you and I probably both know this, which is that if you think you can, and if you think you can't, you're probably right. And what I mean by that is that our democracy and our economic system is like Tinkerbell's light. If people believe in it, then it's going to work. So people will defer, they'll get educated, they'll defer their income, etc. They'll invest for the future. If people believe in the system, then it will work for them. If they don't, and that's when they'll consider their other alternatives. That's why we have to modernize it, and we have to use this inflection point after COVID and after Brexit to create something that's better, more representative of the people that it's seeking to serve.
You describe yourself, as wanting to remain in the EU, and but also as being a realist. And I'm speaking to you from a radio station in Spain, with listeners throughout Europe. And many of us had lived here longer than 15 years, so we're disenfranchised. We couldn't vote in the system. Do you think, was there any inkling, and you know what's going to come next, was there any inkling that there was a desire perhaps to try and return, having seen what's been going on, return to the European Union? Or as a realist and as somebody who has studied politics and been in democracy for a while now, do you think it is a case of drawing a line and getting on with, quote unquote, the will of the people?
Well, I think that ship has sailed. And for the first time in British politics, whether people like it or not, there is a settled view on Europe, and there is also a big majority. This is the biggest majority in a British government for over 30 years, and majorities can create momentum. Our point simply is not to say why is that a great thing or a bad thing. My point personally is that if you've got that sort of majority and you've got that sort of momentum, well, for God's sake, use it. Use it and lay out a vision that people can subscribe to, because unless you lay out that vision of where we're supposed to be going, then that opportunity would be wasted, and then we'll have all the problems that go with it rather than the opportunities.
So looking for a vision, and hopefully it will be found. The book is called Greater Britain After the Storm. Has this book left you then in when you sent that final type that final send button off to your publisher? Did you feel relieved, optimistic, world weary, or you never want to hear any more arguments for devolution, against Europe, whatever, ever again, and you just want to sit down and watch the cricket or something?
Well, I'm the author of many previous books, lucky enough for them to be bestsellers. And one thing you do know is that you ain't going to change the world with a book. If you're going to change the world, it's going to be bit by bit, and books are a very slow burn in terms of whether people get them or whether people read them. And these days, you're competing with a lot of other information. But I'm an optimist. I've built a business around the world, a bit by bit, and I can see what people can do. And there's a lot of people that have left Britain for a better life, for a chance to do something they believe in and can fulfill them. And I just feel that if those people were harnessed and those people brought together, you could create something which is much more exciting and much more visionary. And so to those people, I would say, they're the heroes of this story, the ones that get up and go. They're the heroes of it.
The book is called Greater, Britain After the Storm. It's by Penny Morden and Chris Lewis, and it's available as a virtual download from the TRE bookstore. Chris, if people want to find out more about you, about this book, or about any of your previous works, or want to get in touch and follow you on the social media, where can they find you?
So, at Greater the Book on Twitter, and if you go there, or greater.org, gogreater.org is the website for the book. And if anybody's interested in hearing being more bored to death by me, I'm at Large Burrito on Twitter. And so that's like a grand enchilada, but so much bigger.
Yes, indeed. Grand Burrito. Well, I have no answer to that one, just for one, Chris.
Large Burrito.
And I didn't think we'd be saying that on a Monday morning. But this book is called Greater, Britain After the Storm. It's by Penny Morden and Chris Lewis, who we've been speaking to. Chris, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Charles.